From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. It has been more than 12 years since a Pennsylvania State University climate scientist named Michael Mann woke up to learn that a right-wing media outlet had accused him of having conducted fraudulent research and having engaged in scientific misconduct. Even worse, the published article he read on that morning compared him to Jerry Sandusky, the former Penn State football coach who had been convicted of sexually abusing multiple children. As a scientist, Mann was dumbfounded. As the father of a then six-year-old child, he was disgusted. But as a victim of what he saw as clear defamation, he was determined to fight back. And that fight reached a critical point in early 2024 when a jury in Washington, D.C. determined that the writers of the article had indeed defamed the scientist. And in a world in which climate denial is increasingly shifting from attacks on science to attacks on scientists, that's an important verdict. But Mann's case is just one of many instances in which scientists in general, and climate scientists in particular, are under attack. Earlier this year, the Center for Countering Digital Hate published a report that revealed that personal attacks on scientists are now one of the most common types of online content dismissing climate change. Mann's case was the first high-profile effort for the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, which was founded in 2011 in response to increasing legal attacks on climate scientists. Since then, the center has supported hundreds of scientists whose work has been censored, who have been falsely accused of falsifying their data, who have been personally attacked, and who have even received death threats. But Lauren Kurtz says that the verdict in Michael Mann's case shows that it is possible to fight back, and that it is possible to win. Lauren Kurtz is the executive director of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, a nonprofit based in New York City. Lauren, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Lauren, your group has been really busy this year. You've already had dozens of cases. That's more, in fact, than you've had in the entirety of any single year since you were founded. What's going on with that? Is it because scientists now know that you guys exist, or are we seeing a spike in these sorts of attacks?
I would think both. We really started to get busier in 2016, largely due to the results of the election that year. Scientists, especially at the federal and state government levels, were very concerned about potential implications. So we started hearing more from scientists about how they might be able to protect themselves, which we still hear from. And since then, we've honestly just been busier every single year.
Do you think 2016 emboldened people who might have had some reservations before about going on personal attacks against scientists?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the scientists that we helped in 2016, 2017, 2018, beyond, they were facing attacks from even colleagues within, say, the federal government, people who'd been there for decades and had gotten, like you said, empowered to act in ways that they hadn't previously felt able to do. And so they started doing things more along the lines of like censorship and trying to manipulate other people's research. It was a bit of a free fall at times.
One of the areas that keeps your organization busy is defamation, but that's not all. Talk to me sort of thematically about what's coming in the door, or who's coming in the door. Who are the people who are reaching out and looking for your help?
We really deal with a whole range. I mean, with Michael Mann, actually, we first started working on an open records case that he was facing. He was, at the time, a public university professor at the University of Virginia, and he had been targeted by the then Attorney General of Virginia. The University of Virginia had defended him. He went to the Virginia Supreme Court. The Virginia Supreme Court said this wasn't an appropriate lawsuit by the then Attorney General of Virginia. What happened then was some politicians who also did not believe in the scientific consensus on climate change, they combined forces with a coal-funded group to bring basically a citizen suit against Michael Mann and the University of Virginia, trying to use open records laws. Trying to use them on a public university professor is not really the right fit. And in fact, the Virginia Supreme Court ultimately agreed. But, you know, in the 3 years it took for that case to wind its way through the court, the University of Virginia At one point had threatened to just actually hand over all of Michael Mann's emails to this coal-funded group. And so my group was founded in response to help him fight this, because Virginia law actually had made clear that that wasn't how the law was supposed to be applied, but it took a judge to say that for Dash to be respected.
This was sort of a vexatious request, right? They were on a fishing expedition.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think they wanted something in the range of like 38,000 emails. It was basically everything he'd ever sent or received since he was at the University of Virginia. And on its face, I mean, it was just very clearly a fishing expedition, as you said. You know, they weren't interested in things like his data, his research results. They weren't trying to, you know, reanalyze his published studies, which was what a real scientist would do. A real scientist would try to, you know, replicate and review the published work, which is how science actually progresses. But they were just looking for emails. They were clearly looking for some sort of gotcha type, you know, smoking gun.
Like in those 38,000 emails, there might have been one time where a frustrated Professor Mann said something untoward about someone, and then they would have had it.
Possibly, yeah, or not even that. I mean, the thing about scientists is, you know, they communicate with other scientists, and so they do things like talk in jargon. You know, they use terms that have a specialized meaning within science, and when you take that out of context, it can at times be an attempt to say something completely different.
Lauren, I just realized something, which is that in order to defend Michael Mann, your attorneys probably had to sort through quite a bit of these documents. I mean, like the caffeine intake that it would have taken alone to keep these people awake and paying attention must have been extreme.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually get to a point where you need to review all these emails, it's quite a lot. I mean, we've had, not in this case, but like we had another case where, you know, the scientists were talking about statistical analysis, and they realized that some of the data from the temperature records that they were obtaining, like the sensors, were just clearly wrong because they were so out far of the norm. And so the email said something like, throw out the low numbers. And you can imagine if you get that in the hands of someone who's just determined to reject the scientific consensus on climate change, I mean, that's just a treasure trove, even though it actually is saying something completely different.
That's shorthand for something that we do in data science, as opposed to shorthand for, ha ha ha, we're involved in a deep conspiracy.
Exactly. So in any case, yes. Yeah, so we work on open records cases. We've helped a few scientists this year deal with congressional inquiries, some more good faith, some more bad faith, but helping them navigate that. We've had a few scientists come to us with defamation questions, including scientists who are concerned about, you know, potentially being sued for defamation. Scientists who research things like climate misinformation, and they find evidence of, you know, corporate attempts to obfuscate climate realities, and they want to publish on that, they're concerned about then being sued by, say, you know, giant fossil fuel conglomerate. And so they come to us trying to make sure that they've written it in a way that doesn't pose any legal vulnerabilities, which...
Because they're afraid of slap suits.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they're scientists, they're very precise, but there are additional ways that you can write things that, at least as of today, there's Supreme Court precedent that makes clear that, you know, that this is not a thing that can inherently be considered defamatory. So we, you know, try to give them advice on that front. You know, we've had scientists come to us with, like, you know, they're trying to organize citizen science groups, and they want to make sure that they don't, you know, get anyone into trouble. It's a whole range.
You have noted that you're also seeing more frivolous lawsuits against scientists themselves as well.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes scientists, you know, they get sued, sometimes legitimately, but honestly, I don't think science in general should really be litigated in the courtroom, at least like that. So we've helped scientists who are actually themselves sued for defamation. It's a real grab bag of different ways in which a scientist can find themselves under fire. But I would say as scientists get more public about speaking about their research, and especially as they get more public about speaking about the importance of taking action on climate change, it has really made a number of them targets. And there are people and groups out there that are trying to get them to stop talking.
You know, there's this thing that's often said about censorship, which is that a government entity doesn't have to engage in all that much censorship to have a big effect on the populace, because the populace will start to censor itself. I kind of see some connections here where I am guessing that what you are hearing from these scientists who come to work for you is this real reticence to engage in anything that's going to piss people off, because enough people have been pissed off and that looks really unfun.
Yeah. I mean, the vast majority of scientists that we help, you know, they don't want to be public about what they've gone through because they don't want to attract more additional negative attention. The scientists like Michael Mann, who have not only been very public about what they face, but have actually fought back and even initiated their own lawsuits in defense, that's very rare. The typical scientist we help doesn't have the ability for, you know, various reasons to maybe take on something like that.
Yeah, I think it should be said that, like, a lot of scientists aren't looking for any attention. They're, like, very happy to be anonymously plugging away at their efforts to help us better understand our world. They don't have websites or blogs or podcasts. They don't do interviews.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, as a lawyer, I totally get that. And sometimes, I mean, scientists will even do things like forgo on enforcing their own legal rights because they would rather just get things over as soon as possible. I mean, we had a scientist who was sued a few years ago, and he just wanted to settle as quickly as possible because otherwise it ran the risk of him not being able to do his field research that summer.
That's got to be really frustrating, like when you have a client who, I mean, understandable, obviously, but you have a client who likely has a good case, but justice takes a long time and doesn't always go the way that we want it to go. And so if they just want to get it over with, sometimes they make decisions that might not be in the best interest of everyone down the line, but are in their best interest at that moment.
Yeah. I mean, I totally understood why he wanted to make that decision. It's an example of the ways in which, you know, I think scientists are at a real disadvantage because they don't necessarily have the resources to fight a multi-year litigation. Even, you know, even if we are helping them and providing free legal support, it's still like a huge undertaking for them to be responsible for.
It occurs to me that, you know, in the last decade or so, there's been this real push, particularly coming from like the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, that says, hey, you know what? Like, scientists have to get better at communication. We can't just be in our labs doing our stuff anymore. We all have to be scientific communicators now. And, you know, in response to this, a lot of graduate programs have implemented curriculum in communication. And I really wish we lived in a world in which scientists didn't have to have any preparatory education on legal matters and the law and the potential that they might be dragged into the legal arena. But that's such an increasing risk for scientists in general, maybe climate scientists in particular, that I guess what I was wondering about aloud was whether you think that we would be doing the community well by preparing them better for the fact that, you know, this might be part of your future. There might come a time where somebody sends you a records request for 38,000 records or hits you with a slap suit.
I agree. I mean, we actually do trainings for scientists just to get them prepared for the possibility of this. I think the likelihood of a scientist getting targeted does go up the more active they are in certain realms. But, you know, no one's totally safe. I went to a seminar a few years ago run by a scientist who'd been embroiled in a completely terrible, frivolous lawsuit. And one of the pieces of advice he gave his graduate students was about how to organize their emails. So if they ever got involved in a lawsuit, at least they wouldn't have to spend quite so much time doing document review over multiple chains of emails. That could do it more efficiently. And I thought that was both very good advice and also very depressing.
Right. Like, if there's a good enough chance that this will happen to you, that it behooves you to spend time doing this ahead of time instead of leaning over a lab bench or a computer or going out and collecting data. The other thing you've written is that we've seen this real substantial increase in recent years in political interference into the work of scientists. But back in 2021, President Biden issued a memorandum on scientific integrity that was actually, it was one of the first things he did as president. It's just a week into his tenure in office. And this presumably kickstarted this effort to better protect researchers. Do you think that has been effective?
Yes. So his administration has done a number of things to better strengthen these internal agency policies, which is great. Not every agency has finalized their policies yet. I would have loved to see this happen sooner, but better late than never. And a lot of the final policies are actually coming out now, and then they are better, which is great.
Wait. So we're almost to election time and the policies are just now coming out, which means that in a few months' time, we might blow that up and start over again.
Yeah. I mean, the Biden administration took their time and they did things through the, you know, the administrative protocols. One would hope that a future administration would be careful if they decided to change anything about that, but it's really, who knows? I mean, what really needs to happen is to have some congressional legislation, but Congress has not really shown any sort of widespread appetite to make that happen, unfortunately.
Is any of it bipartisan? Is it coming from both sides of the aisle, or is it really only coming from one side of the aisle?
It did have bipartisan support, but unfortunately, it wasn't as bipartisan as it needed to be. I don't know if the dust settles on some things. Maybe, you know, there'll be more appetite for both Democrats and Republicans to talk about this. But right now, it has largely been a Democrat-led effort.
If I give you a magic wand today and I'm like, here you go, write some legislation, but you only got 15 minutes to do it, what do you do? Like, what do you, you're like, this has to get done right now. It will help the most people most of the time. What would be the one thing?
I mean, there are a lot of things I think you could do in 15 minutes, but I mean, my specialty is obviously I'm very interested in helping federal scientists be more protected from things like political interference. And so I would love to see some congressional legislation that speaks to that. Even something very rudimentary would be better than what we have now, which is nothing.
Talk to me about biology student Lauren Kurtz.
I did not initially think I would go to law school. I'm not sure I really knew what I wanted to do, but I thought the sciences were really interesting. I enjoyed lab work. Wasn't totally sure if I would make a career of it, but it just seemed like a good technical foundation for a variety of different jobs. And then one summer I did a research study, which it was fascinating. It was a really interesting study on conservation biology and native bees. But I also felt kind of, in a way, almost disheartened by it because I felt like the study was coming up with really interesting things. And the professors, you know, the career scientists on this were like, yep, that makes sense. Yep, that makes sense. And it just became clear to me that, like, none of the policymakers or, you know, the people who actually make decisions about, say, land use or pesticide use were incorporating any of the science. And I just thought that was such a shame. I mean, to have all this, like, very clear-cut research about the ways in which native bees were being imperiled and nothing actually being done to save them. So that was when I really started thinking about law school as a way to maybe bridge that gap.
You know, most people, they don't ever want to be in a position in which they feel they have to talk to a lawyer. It's really only when things feel desperate that this is an experience that people engage in. So talk to me about the mindset of the scientists when they finally reach out to your organization. It does sound like some are being proactive and saying, I am concerned that this might happen. But I assume there's a lot who have tried to do things themselves and then have just realized that they're in over their head and they really are being attacked. The people who are on the other side of things aren't acting in good faith.
Yeah, I think a lot of them actually don't want to contact a lawyer right away because they see, you know, getting a lawyer involved as maybe escalating the situation. When the reality is, like, if you need a lawyer, like, the situation's already escalated. I remember a few years ago, we had a scientist who had gotten targeted by a pretty anti-science member of Congress, and he'd been navigating it on his own, actually, for a bit. And then his colleagues in his department were like, this is not going to go well. You need to get a lawyer so that you can enforce your rights. And he called me up and he said, I just want to talk to the congressperson. I'm sure that this can all be explained. You know, unfortunately, that wasn't the fight that was actually being fought. And so we work a lot with various pro bono firms. So we had a former congressional staff attorney, former federal prosecutor, help push back on this totally bogus attack, which ultimately did go nowhere. I mean, I think it was a total exercise in waste of taxpayer funds, but I would have loved if the scientists had been right. A simple phone call could have resolved it, but, you know, the politician wanted to do a big political show about it.
Are these scientists often surprised to find themselves in this position that they can't just talk to someone like human beings?
That's not the only example. I think it's one of the most clear cut. And I think it was, like, such a purity of heart and such, like, a career scientist, you know, really dealing with facts and figures and reality who got thrust in this alternate universe where none of that mattered. But yeah, I think there are scientists who are just totally shocked at the inefficiencies of the legal system, which are honestly pretty shocking. I mean, we've been in touch with a scientist who got sued by a pesticide company. He's an ecologist. And the pesticide company, I mean, just they had no case. They had no case at all. But the judge in the matter, I guess, wanted to give the benefit of the doubt and maybe was a little bit confused. And it took, I want to say, 3 or 4 years, you know, for that finally to actually make it so that, you know, the pesticide company had to drop their case.
I assume also that these scientists who are reticent to engage in the legal process at first are really worried about cost. You guys are donor funded. How's that going?
I mean, we're a small shop, so we largely depend on individual donations. We don't have any major, you know, PAC level funding, but, you know, they're actually, we're a very small team. What has been so helpful for us is doing things like partnering with large law firms who, you know, just from like a principal stake have been very generous with their time.
So you're a conduit to pro bono attorneys elsewhere.
Oftentimes, yeah. I mean, if we have a big case, that's really the only way we can effectively represent a scientist. But the kinds of cases that we're involved in, I mean, in many ways, they're just like they're core free speech cases. And I think there are a lot of firms out there that get the stakes and are happy to donate their time, which we're so grateful for.
You've noted before that skepticism and criticism are appropriate in science. I don't actually know any scientists who would disagree with that at all. Talk to me a little bit about where the line is, because this is tricky, right? I mean, it's not always easy to know who's being disingenuous and who has honest questions about methods and motives.
Yes, that's a fair question. I mean, I think especially there's a lot of disputes in pretty much any area of science, you know, biomedicine, urology, health stuff in general is also a very contentious area at times. One of the reasons that I like working in climate is I accept the scientific consensus on climate change. And so for me, there's some very clear through lines on the kind of fights that make sense and the kind of fights that don't. We have had scientists come to us because they have gotten into, you know, a squabble with another scientist. And I'm not really interested in splitting hairs. We actually don't help scientists bring defamation cases. The Michael Mann case that you referenced earlier, you know, we've supported Michael Mann in his FOIA case, but his defamation case actually predates us, which is how long it's been going on. So yeah, I mean, there are definitely legit disputes in the sciences. Some of them may involve, you know, very cranky scientists, but that's not really what we're involved in. And we're really trying to help scientists who are getting targeted because of their work in ways that are inappropriate. You know, we're not here to like mediate good faith scientific disputes, even if they're, you know, hostilely done.
Lauren, I know you're proud of your organization, rightfully. So I want to make sure I frame this in the right way. Like, I think it's good that your organization exists, but it also seems really sad that your organization exists.
No, you nailed it. It's a bit painful. Like, I am glad to be here. I think of us as one of the last lines of defense against, you know, misinformation. But I would love for the goalpost to be moved and for this type of work to not be necessary.
Do you think we get there? Is that a possible future, or is this a battle that we're going to be waging for a really long time?
I think it's a battle, unfortunately, we're going to be waging for a while. I do think that it's changed in ways that in some ways are disappointing, but in some ways, to me, actually indicate some positive trends. I mean, Michael Mann, especially in the early days, he was targeted for the scientific reality of his research. I mean, people just accused him blatantly of making things up. And we still have that, but not nearly as much. Now, climate scientists are attacked because it's a much more nebulous thing in a way, and that makes it more dangerous. But the arguments seem to be along the lines that, you know, a scientist doesn't have the right to speak, or a scientist, you know, did something inappropriate by speaking publicly about climate change, or that they're biased or they have a conflict of interest or something. I mean, they're trying to undercut the researchers in, you know, also very aggressive and in appropriate ways, but the actual acceptance of the scientific reality of climate change has come a long way, which I think is positive.
That's Lauren Kurtz. She is the executive director of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, a nonprofit based in New York City that provides legal assistance to researchers and institutions engaged in climate science. You can learn more about her work at csldf.org. Lauren Kurtz, thank you.
Thank you. This was great.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.